Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Proper Mental Podcast. Welcome specifically to episode 125 of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is Sally Orange, who is an endurance runner, an adventurer, a public speaker, and a mental health campaigner. And strap yourselves in, right? Because I think this could be the most impressive intro that I've ever read out. So are you ready for this? Sally holds 11 Guinness World Records. She has ran over 70 marathons, completed 8 Ironman triathlons, and she's also completed 22 years service in the Royal Army Medical Corps as a physiotherapy officer, which included an operational tour of Afghanistan. Amongst other things, she's captained the first British female team to complete the relentless Race Across America, which is the world's toughest cycle race. She's also ran the toughest foot race on earth, which is the Marathon des Sables in the Sahara Desert. She cycled the length of New Zealand, swam the English Channel Relay, and she skied across the largest plateau in the Arctic Circle. And most of these things she has done dressed as various pieces of fruit or vegetables to raise awareness around mental health, to break down stigma and to start conversation. And I think the most mind-blowing thing in all of that is that Sally didn't run her first marathon until she was 34. And in this episode, we talk about that. We talk about why she started running and how that led to running a marathon, which led to running loads of marathons all over the world. We talk about her own lifelong mental health challenges and how she balances looking after herself with taking part in these endurance events. We talk about her fancy dress and how she uses that to start conversations around mental health. And we talk about her 22 years in the army. And we also talk about her most recent challenge, which is the World Marathon Challenge, which involved running 7 marathons over 7 days on 7 different continents in 7 different fancy dress outfits. So yeah, we cover a lot of ground in this episode. It was amazing chatting to Sally. Some of the things she's done are absolutely incredible, but it was really incredible to hear the story behind them. You know, the mental health journey that she's been on that kind of underpins all of this stuff. And yeah, I was just blown away by all of it. I came off this recording just wanting to put my running shoes on, really. And if you've listened to the show for a while, you know I've got kind of a hate-hate relationship with running. So for someone to inspire me to go for a run, well, it must have been a good chat, right? All the links to everything that Sally does is in the episode notes. There's links to her socials, links to her website, and there's loads of info there about the upcoming challenges, some of which she mentions as part of this episode. If you want to get hold of me, you can find me on social media. You can get hold of me via the website. Go and have a look on there. There's loads of stuff to read about the podcast and me and previous guests and all that stuff all on the website. More important than all of that, if you could take 2 minutes to rate and review this episode or any other episode, all that stuff is really, really important. And I'd really appreciate it if you could do me a solid and make that happen. Other than that, that's everything you need to know. This is episode 125 of the Proper Mental Podcast with Sally Orange. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. So here we are with another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is Sally Orange. How are you, mate?
I'm good, thank you. Lovely to chat with you today.
Oh, mate, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it. What's the snow situation where you are, mate?
You know, looking out the window, there isn't any at all.
So wow.
I feel very left out. But in a few weeks' time, I will have more snow than anybody because I'm going to the North Pole.
Wow, is that the kind of the next challenge on the horizon?
Yeah, that's the next marathon at the North Pole. So yeah, it's a shame I haven't got any because that would be good training. But lovely seeing people making snowmans and all that kind of thing. So
we've just had a message through this morning that the school's closed, so I've got the kids home and everything. So if there's any background noise, it's chaos downstairs. but there we go. I suppose the question you always get asked whenever you sign up for like a new marathon or a new challenge is, have you got the outfit sorted yet?
I have. I do often get that. But yes, I have got it sorted for this one. And I'm going to be a slice of lime. So I'm going to be ice and a slice.
Ah, yeah.
So this has actually been cancelled for 3 years in a row. But last year I still went to Svalbard, which is, part of Norway, which is where you then fly to the North Pole from. And I went there last year and skied across from coast to coast of Svalbard, carrying everything in my pulk. And I did that dressed as a slice of lemon. So I was ice and a slice on skis. So I now thought I'll be ice and a slice on top of the world.
Yeah. Do you, this is probably a really daft question, but the costume you wear, do you wear a different one when you're in those temperatures? Like, do you have it like lined or, does it just,
No, I haven't. I don't have them lined, although this one, a little bit like when I did one in Antarctica. Well, I've done two in Antarctica now. I did one dressed as a pair. So that kind of did encompass my head in it. And I do like telling people that I got my nice pair out in Antarctica and their minds wander onto different things. But I also did a pod of peas a couple of weeks ago because I knew I was going to be frozen. So I was frozen peas. But this lime, again, does sort of encompass my face. So it is a bit of a windshield. So whilst for a lot of people, they might think it's a hindrance, it potentially will be a help. It's not the most aerodynamic, but let's face it, I'm not going for, the fastest marathon ever being in the North Pole.
Yeah, that's it. Any like little help and little advantages, we'll take it, right? Very much so in those conditions.
Well, I've got my ski goggles on and everything. And actually in Antarctica, when everybody had, you've got ski goggles on, you've got buffs over your nose, and you couldn't tell who anybody was. Everybody knew who I was because there was this great big pot of peas running along. And, on the video, everyone knows who I am. And the photo, photos are really, really good to spot yourself. So,
I bet for, like, people maybe on, I don't know, the support crews, because I was going to say people watching, but I'm sure the streets aren't lined like they are.
No, it's not quite like London Marathon.
But yeah, people probably, see you coming around the corner and think it's some sort of like ice mirage, like I've been out in the cold too long, I'm seeing peas floating around the place. And Sally, there's going to be people listening to this who are thinking, what the heck are they talking about? So let's rewind a little bit. And I thought probably the best place to jump in is kind of at the start of your running journey. Have you always been a runner? Is that something you've always been passionate about?
I, as a child, I did quite like running, but then unfortunately at the age of 16, I went ice skating for the day and broke my leg. And I was in hospital for a month because I had to have metal work in it. And unfortunately, when I was in hospital, my boyfriend at the time, who had actually fallen on my leg when we were ice skating, he went off with one of my best friends while I was in hospital. So it wasn't the greatest time of my life. And that was 16, and I didn't then run again until I was 34. So it's, back in the day as well, the marathons weren't a thing really. I remember watching the very first London Marathon and thinking, wow, I want to do that one day. And then I just had this fear that I would never be able to do that. I just saw these people as just incredible people. How could they ever do that? And I remember a friend's dad doing that first one and seeing his medal and just, thinking that he was, absolutely incredible. And she brought his medal to school. So it took quite a long time after before I did it. But when I did that one, my very first marathon, I decided to do it dressed as Supergirl, so as a superhero. And I can honestly feel when I crossed that finish line, I felt like a superhero for the first time in my life, probably. And yeah, that feeling, I can relive that feeling if I want to. It was so powerful. And I ended up getting the Guinness World Record for the fastest marathon dressed as a superhero. So that was an added bonus as well. Kind of where it first started.
Oh, mate. So you really did, you started from scratch, really. And I always think that's important to mention, because we see people do, like, I think anyone who runs a marathon is amazing, right? I just think it's an incredible feat. And we see it on telly. And because you see thousands of people running it on telly, you think that thousands of people are running marathons. That's just not the case. It's an incredible achievement, right? And when people run lots of marathons like yourself, we forget that you know, you weren't born a marathon runner, right? You had to start at 34, and you know, probably I'm gonna make an assumption here, Sally, but maybe went for like a short run and it might not have been that pleasant, but then you have to put your shoes on and go again and build up to it, and the whole process to it is a big thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, and I'd say probably even breaking it down even more, it didn't start with the first run, it was a walk run. So you know, thinking, right, I'm not going to be able to do that far, so it's breaking it down and going, well, what can I do, and if I've managed that before, what can I do next? I'll just add a little bit on. So and I always say to people who are doing their first marathon, you know, so many people worry about time or other people. It's not maybe the people who are doing the marathon, but other people will say, what time are you going for? And I have never gone for a time, so I just tell people that I'm going for the time of my life. Because for me, it's about the actual enjoyment of the marathon. It's not about how quickly I can get them. For anyone doing their first marathon, it's going to be a PB anyway, because they've never done it before. So, yeah, that's how I look at it. And that, for me, takes away the pressure of, you know, the anxiety of, you know, putting, you know, pressure on yourself and then potentially feeling like you haven't achieved. Because if you haven't met that time, then people can feel like a failure and they can beat themselves up. So I try and take that out of any of the events. I don't even call them races, because a race makes it sound as though there's going to be a first, second, and third, whereas an event, we all get a medal, everybody who finishes the you know, the marathon, and it doesn't matter if you've done it in 2.5 hours or whether you've done it in 6.5 hours, you still get the same medal.
Yeah, that's it. It's such a lovely way to look at it. And you're right, people do make such a fuss about the time. It's something that I notice. I work with a lot of runners, you know, in my day job, and people always say to me, and they'll come back after the race and I'll say, oh, you know, how did the marathon go? And they'll be like, oh yeah, you know, it was good. I mean, it wasn't the fastest. And you think like, don't play down what you've achieved. You've been working at this for months, and you know, when people say it's not the fastest, you want to say, well, you're not Mo Farah. I wasn't expecting you to come back and do it in 3 hours. No one was, you know. It's, but we almost take that away from ourselves, the feel good factor. It's like we don't want to celebrate the achievement, right? We're not very good at kind of bigging ourselves up, right?
We're certainly not. And I've been, because I've been all around the world, I've met people from all around the world. And, you know, Americans are brilliant in that they will wear their medal for the next 2 or 3 days, and they'll sit in a restaurant wearing their medal. And so people will ask them about it. Whereas, you know, we're British and we think, well, we can wear it on the day of the marathon and maybe go to work with it the next day. But then that's it. I mean, mine are just in a box, or you know, all my medals, they're not even, people say, oh, you know, are they out on show? No, they're just in a box. So that's why I like the memories that I've got, and you might as well make it a positive memory rather than a you know, a negative one of, oh, I didn't get that time. So yeah, it's just turning the situation around, I guess.
Yeah, very much so. I often think as well about training, particularly for distances, right, is you can kind of take that mindset that you need to be able to go and do 20 miles on a Sunday when you really don't want to, because you did 18 last Sunday, right? And, you know, when you really don't want to, you can take that mindset and apply it to different things. Because a lot of people don't think they're going to be able to run a marathon until they cross the finish line. And then they do. And then maybe a job comes up at work and you think, oh, I'm not going to get that. And you think, well, hang on a minute, I didn't think I could run a marathon and I did that, so maybe I can do this. And that sort of that mindset, it builds, doesn't it? It kind of changes how we see ourselves.
Certainly does. And you know, really good point there, because when I was training for my most recent challenge, which was the World Marathon Challenge, which was 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days, you know, I thought, I'm not going to be able to do this. And I then got injured and I had a stress fracture and I couldn't actually train. So I thought, right, I'm going to use that time to train my mind and sort of build on my resilience. So I contacted a resilience coach, and he used that exact concept. It's called the cookie jar concept. And it's from David Goggins, who is looking back at putting what cookies can you put in this jar? What previous positive experiences have you got that make you realize you can do things? So, you know, a marathon would be a great example to go in there. And when you're finding things tough, so on the World Marathon Challenge, I had to dip into that virtual cookie jar on several occasions to tell me, yeah, but you did this before, Sally, so you can do this. You just need to. So you get that almost that sugar rush of the virtual memory to push you forward. So I use that, you know, quite a few times. And now in my cookie jar is the World Marathon Challenge, because that is something else that I've achieved. And at times, you know, I didn't think I would. So that's another cookie in the jar.
Yeah, you can't argue with the facts, right? And when that voice in your head is at you and it's lying to you, then you can prove it wrong with the facts. But how did you go then from like running one marathon to doing, you know, 7 7 7 challenges? Was it just a case of on to the next? Because most people run one and they say never again, and then quite
and
often
honestly,
do it again,
that
right?
Was my exact words as I crossed that finish line of that very first marathon, never again. And but then I think it's that, you know, that type A fun that at the time it's maybe not the, you know, not the easiest and most, you know, the best thing at the time, but you've finished. And I think it's what people say, I don't have children, but it's like childbirth. You know, you still go back and do it. You know, it might be the most horrendous thing, but you still go back and do it again, because you forget that part of it. And your brain is, it's clever, it's cruel, it's, you know, sometimes it will make you remember the difficult things, but other times it will wipe out all the memories of the pain and just can see the positive parts of it and makes you think, hey, do you know what, I want that feeling again. So I after I'd had that never again, I thought, yeah, you know, I want to do that again. But I have only ever had charity places for the London Marathon, apart from this year will be my 10th London Marathon. And I got a ballot place, so I'm still doing it for charity, but I haven't got the pressure quite so much. I kind of thought, well, how do I raise money? I've already raised loads of money. How do I do it again? I'm gonna have to do something almost bigger and better. So that's where I thought, I'll run as an orange. My surname's Orange, and I'll run as a piece of fruit. And got the fastest marathon, you know, the Guinness World Record for the fastest marathon dressed as a piece of fruit. And it was fun. People smiled. It was really nice to make people smile. And I ended up going to Afghanistan and getting a banana costume sent out and doing a marathon in Afghanistan dressed as a banana. And I kind of realized that, yeah, you know, I had a friend do that one in Afghanistan with me, and she was at the time trying to get a time to do the Commonwealth Games. So, you know, really, really great runner. And she said to me after the marathon, what she did with me, she said, that was the most fun marathon I've ever done. So it kind of made me realize that there was a different way of doing, you know, of doing marathons. And then there became the more serious side to the costume, because I kind of realized that when you're in a sea of, you know, thousands of other people who are dressed in their shorts and t-shirt, and you're dressed as a apple, orange, banana, or something bright, then first of all, it made them smile. You know, when I've never gone past anyone who's kind of, you know, might get a few strange looks, but people smile. And then they ask you why. And I realized it was a really great way to get the message across about what I was wanting to raise awareness for. So, and that is breaking down the stigma associated with poor mental health, because people would say why, and I tell them I'm trying to break that stigma. And more often than not, somebody will say, I've struggled, or I know someone who's struggled. And it really subtly starts that conversation in a way that they never thought, coming and asking an apple or an orange, that they would start talking about depression or suicide. And it just normalizes that conversation in a really subtle way. And if people don't want to talk about it, then we go back to talking about the costume or the race or the running. So it's just an opening for people, if they want to make them realize it's fine to talk about it. But I think if I had a t-shirt on me that said, come and talk to me about mental health, some people would, but others would run a mile because they wouldn't want to do it. So it then just became a really fun way in the sort of the message behind it, but also how I go about it, and not putting that pressure on myself to get a certain time. And just the more people I talk to, the more stories that I learn about. I like finding out why other people are doing things. Sometimes I might be able to help motivate somebody through, you know, if they, I find them sort of walking, you know, just a pat on the back saying, you know, you're doing great, can be that inspiration for someone to go, yeah, I just can do this again. So such a powerful medium, really, in a really growing community of so many different people.
Yeah, it's a lovely way to kind of, like, I suppose, Trojan horse it into mainstream conversation. And that's so important. I've say that, like, versions of this on this podcast a lot, but the mental health conversation, it tends to happen for the majority with people who are already comfortable having it, you know. So it's very easy for me and you to sit here and talk about it, but what about that person who hasn't had that conversation, who doesn't have the words and is getting told messages all the time to talk about it, and they don't know how, and they don't know where, and they don't know who to, right? So to have that in, and I think talking about these things in, you know, outside of outside of mental health spaces. So it's not in the doctor's room, it's not in the therapy room, it's not, do you know what I mean? To be like, you know, yeah, running a race, or, you know, like out in the normal world, that really is normalizing these conversations. And it can, yeah, brings people in who might not get that opportunity to have that conversation if there's not an opportunity for them to join in that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And you know, I was speaking to someone just before, and I was sort of explaining to them that they were asking me, what would you say to somebody who was struggling? And I know that we all say talk, reach out, but actually listening is a really powerful tool as well, because the people that recognize that you're not doing so well are usually other people that recognize before yourself. And they will quite often say, why, you know, is everything okay? And, you know, there are those signs. But we push them away because we don't want to, you know, so often we don't want to accept that there potentially is a problem. So I think it's really important to listen to those people that might be saying, you're not quite yourself at the moment, or, I've realised it's really, really powerful for somebody who's unwell to listen as well as to talk. And I think the listening becomes before the talking. Because we don't realize ourselves all the time.
That's so true, isn't it? A lot of people, they don't know what's happening to them, particularly if it's new or if it's something that they've kept secret for a long time. They don't really know what it is. That was certainly my experience. You know, people say to me, why didn't you say anything? It's like, well, I didn't know what was happening. You know, I didn't have the words. It wasn't on my radar until it was on my radar, you know? Yeah. And yeah, like you say, I think sometimes we can learn how to speak for ourselves through hearing the experiences of others, right? Borrowing other people's words. You hear one person say one thing and you think, oh, I really relate to that. That's how I will describe what is happening to me when I speak to someone else. It's it's so much more complex, isn't it, than just telling people to talk, I suppose.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's exactly what you're doing with this podcast. It's getting people to listen. You're getting people to listen to other people talking, but the power of this podcast is actually on listening rather than talking. Yes, you've got one person talking, but you might have thousands. I'm sure in your case, Tom, you've got millions.
Oh, millions. Yeah.
To this podcast. And yeah, it's the listening that might get people to hopefully reach out and talk in the future. But also, I think it's really important to know that there's different avenues as well. There's time you do not want to talk. You don't want to, you might know that you need help, but shout is a really great medium where you can text and you can just talk to somebody that you don't know via text, which is something that most people are sort of comfortable with doing. I certainly know when I've not been well, just getting that text at times. Well, when we know the science behind it, you get the oxytocin, the rush of hormones that somebody's reached out and somebody's just thought about you. And certainly at times that has got me through some really bad days where I haven't wanted to, I haven't spoke to anybody, but at least I've had a text. I haven't even replied, but I've had someone think about me in that day. So it's what suits, you know, different people. So when we're not all talking, not everybody's a talker anyway. Some people are, you know, they don't like social situations of having to talk to other people, but they might be quite introvert, but they like listening. Very different and powerful communication tools in both listening and talking.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's just why the support is so important in the mental health, like all the different supports and the charities and stuff that's out there is, you know, there's just the variation, isn't it? So there's something for everyone, because there's loads that I look at and I think you are doing amazing work, but I wouldn't use your service. And that's nothing against the service. It just, it wouldn't work for me personally. But if there's so many, and I spoke to, I've got a pal called John Salmon, who I met through this podcast, who's a wonderful campaigner. And he said something to me. He said that, the signposting is the new awareness, you know, so like letting people know about Shout and about these organizations, because again, you don't know about them till after you need them. When it's too late, you tend to find out about these things. But there's some wonderful people out there day in, day out, doing incredible things in their local communities, and you know, people just need to know about them, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, just an analogy of what you were just saying there, it's like, it's almost like walking into a clothes shop, that we're not all going to want to buy the same clothes. We're, you know, they won't all fit us. They won't, the size or the approach or the style won't be us. But if you've got an array of them and you kind of have them presented to you, you can then choose which of those would be best for you and which suits you. And I've raised money for over 50 different charities now, and some people say to me, well, do you not feel a bit disloyal because you're raising for, you know, you don't stick with the same one, and that's who you always raise for? And you know, I've said no, because actually I get to learn about a new charity and what they do, and that means then that I can signpost other people to what feels applicable to them. So you know, it's been just an enriching and learning process, finding what the different charities do. They still all resonate with me, but just in, you know, in different ways. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, it's just comforting, isn't it, knowing that these things are out there. It's just really, really, it's just really nice. It's just really, really comforting, eh? But you mentioned your own lived experience there, Sally. When did that sort of start for you, mate? When did you start to struggle initially with your mental health?
Oh, I've struggled for over 25 years now. So I think it was when, just after I'd, well, if I think back, at the time, I struggled with exams, and that was exam stress, and you know, just that's what it was called. Then I ended up joining the army, and you know, I put more and more pressure on myself. And I suppose you've got lived experience of how you've been brought up, of how you should sort of deal with different situations, and it was always sort of bubbling under the surface. I mean, anxiety. I remember at 4 years old, you know, sitting on the stairs, wondering when my, you know, mum and dad would come, you know, when they've come home, and worrying that they've been in a car accident, and what if they didn't come? And just that has just always been with me, the anxiety. And I was just called a worrier. You know, I was just known as a bit of a worrier. But over time, it was more than just a, you know, a bit of a worry. And now that I've had help with that, I've can manage those situations better, but I didn't have the tools when I was younger to manage going into a, you know, something where I didn't know anybody, or you know, the fear of doing things. And you know, don't get me wrong, fear is really helpful in some ways, and I think a brilliant film for people of any age to watch is Inside Out. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
You know, yeah.
Children's film, but it just shows that all of these emotions that we have are useful. If we have too much of them, then that's when they can become a problem. But you know, if you have too much happiness, it's the same as if we have too much rain or too much sunlight. But yeah, I think it was actually in 2013 when I'd had quite a few patches of feeling suicidal, but this was just on a, and that would maybe last for a week, and I'd just be in bed crying. But this was a completely different level on 2013. And you know, I'd sort of made plans, and you know, things were very, very different. And I couldn't function. It, you know, I had to be looked after. I was close to getting sectioned, but I wasn't actually sectioned. I had the help of the crisis team, which pretty much saved my life. My GP and the crisis team did save my life, no doubt about it. And I've found myself back in that place a couple of times since, but I think I've now just got much better coping strategies that I start to feel myself going downhill. You know, before I'd explained that it just felt like I was just walking off a cliff and I didn't have a slippery slope. You know, people talk about they can feel themselves going down. For me, it would be feeling okay 1 minute and then the next minute I was suicidal. But now I can start to recognize, and there's a couple of triggers that make me think, if I don't feel great, I'll think, have you taken your medication? Have you had some sleep? Because they are my two worst things that I know that if I put them right, then, you know, things are likely to get better. And if they're still okay, then I need to tap into, you know, maybe I do know to book another therapist session. You know, I still see my therapist, you know, once a month, which, you know, at times it was two or three times a week. So that's progress. But actually, I have no shame. If I called them a coach, you know, it's the same thing really. But the fact that they're called a therapist, if I was to say I saw my life coach once, you know, once a month, no one would think anything to that, and they would actually think, gosh, how positive. You see life, you're looking at your personal growth, and, you know, actually a therapist is doing, you know, a very similar thing. They're just giving me the tools to, sometimes tools that we've learned before, but I've just forgotten about, and they've said, right, you need to get that one back out again. Oh yeah, you know, do you remember? No, just remind me. And yeah, so I see that as almost like a personal trainer, you know, as the physical equivalent is a personal trainer, in that we can do a lot of it ourselves. Sometimes we need a personal trainer to train us in the first place, to then say, off you go, do it on your own. But you'll get into bad habits and you'll forget some of the things that you were taught. So you might need to go back to that that personal trainer. So yeah, just the word therapist has stigma attached to it, but if we called him a coach, it would be a positive thing.
Yeah, that's so true. Such a good point. And I love that about forgetting those tools. I do that so often myself. You know, I very, very similar, Sally. I started therapy because I was in crisis, and now I go to therapy like halfly because it keeps me well, and the other half because I quite enjoy the sort of exploration. I think it makes me better at being all the things I have to be. It makes me a better dad and a better husband and all that sort of stuff, you know. But yeah, quite often, someone will mention something on this podcast and I'll think, I used to do that. And when I did it, I swore by it and I don't do it now. And I should bring it back, you know, or yeah, talk about something in therapy. And I said, when did I stop doing that? Because that's really important for me. And we do, don't we? We're spinning all these plates and sometimes some of those plates stop spinning.
You think that I'm a real fashion person that keep talking about clothes, but how often do we forget the clothes that we've got in our drawers and then we'll suddenly find one, go, oh yeah, I really like that. Why don't I? And then that'll be the flavour of the, you know, of the week or the month for a while. But yeah, anything that we haven't, you know, you use it or you lose it, because it's not at the forefront, and our brains are designed to, they can only hold so much stuff. And on that point, I also have learned that when I'm not very well, everything becomes very hazy. And so now on my phone, I even have to have a list of the things that make me feel good, because when I go into that dark hole, I can't even see that. I can't even see who are the people that I call. It just becomes this nothingness of negativity and, well, there's no one who will listen. And, you know, I can't do, nothing makes me feel better. But actually when you, if I do something now and it makes me feel good, that goes onto my list. So, you know, and that's a varying degrees of, you know, maybe, you know, having a bath or changing your clothes. You know, the things when you don't feel that great and you're in, you know, you might be in bed for a week, and you think, oh, I can't bother to change, you know, you just fester, you really do fester. But actually then just putting on, you know, something different can, yeah, or even just cleaning your teeth, you know, how much better do we feel for cleaning our teeth? But there are times when you just think, I can't, I always think this was the hangover as well, actually. I think, why don't I just get up and have that drink of water? Oh, because actually getting to go and get the water is too much hard work, even though you know that the water and cleaning your teeth will make you feel so much better.
Yeah, it's so true, isn't it? You can see it on the side, yeah. But the idea of getting up is just too much. But yeah, I think
actually that's, I've only just literally come up with that, but that is possibly a way for us who have experienced it. You know, you might have people listen to this podcast that they haven't got a problem themselves, but they're maybe with somebody who has a problem. They don't understand it, and they might be able to understand it a bit more by talking about that hangover scenario, that you know what will make you feel better, but actually, you know, getting to do A and B to get you to C is so hard. I think that's something that I might use to sort of explain to people how it, when they say, what do you mean you can't get out of bed? You run marathons, how can you not get out of bed? And they just can't see the, you know, how the two can go together.
It's so easy to forget the importance of those like 1% things, isn't it? That, you know, that thing, you know, again, I had a guest called Dr. Mike, and he talked to me about that those 1% things, you know, those little things, and you add up those 1% and it makes a huge difference. And, you know, you can kind of, all you need to do is kind of just take care of yourself through it, right? You know, ride it out. And that's you mentioned the cookie jar before for when you're running, but it's the same, isn't it, for when you're in that hole, is you need proof that you've done it before and you can do it again. It's kind of like the same thing, I think.
And I think we actually end up getting that proof every single day, because we've got through that day every day. We wake up the next day and, you know, we've got 100% success rate of getting through each day.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It's a great way to look at it. Yeah. You mentioned medication, you mentioned sleep and therapy. Are there other things, Sally, that kind of helped you from that crisis point as you started to rebuild? That's always the interesting bit for me, you know, because I kind of think like, I don't know if it serves people listening to dwell in the sadness. I don't think that helps. And sometimes we jump too quickly from the sad bit to where we are now. And it's the middle bit where people kind of get stuck. But how did you kind of, you know, it sounds like you had a lot of like support, you know, through the GP and stuff like that. Was it just a case of just working those systems to get back on your feet?
There were so many other things as well. When I look back, you know, medication, that took years, because I try some and some made me, first of all, it was getting over the stigma of going on to medication. Didn't want to do it. You know, and I know, but I know that with physical, you know, my background is actually as a physiotherapist. So I know with physical injuries that people often don't want to take painkillers, because they say, yeah, but the pain's there to remind me that there's a problem. So I don't want to mask it. It's just masking it. And I have to explain to people with a physical injury that by taking the medication, it takes the pain away so they can do the things that will help. So moving often helps a joint get better. And actually they'll get to the point where they no longer need to take the pain relief. So yeah, first of all, it was a case of lots of different medications, and even that was difficult, because some would make you feel worse before they made you feel better, and that's hard to understand, that concept of how that happens. And then it didn't go straight to therapy. You know, actually, it's, some of them was group therapy, which was just the most daunting thing, you know, of having to go to a group. But in some ways, it was really useful, because I didn't have to speak. I could listen to other people. So it's that stepping stone, really, to get to before I actually told anything about myself. You know, I was perhaps hearing other people say how they had benefited. So yeah, you know, the group therapy, and then the individual sort of talking, and you know, I spoke about coaching before. It's all a spectrum, that you've got coaching and counselling and therapy, and you know, counselling, you don't get, it's basically you just having the opportunity to voice things that are on your mind. You know, a counsellor will not actually, or they shouldn't, give you examples of what you should, it's kind of you working it out yourself. But I think a therapist is when you're probably more unwell and you do need the help in what tools there are. But a coach or a therapist or a coach is more about helping you work it out yourself. But I definitely think they're all on the same continuum. And then exercise. I would say that running has saved my life. But there's times when I've not been able to run, and so it's walking, even just walking. And quite often just reframing things. There's been times when I've walked in a marathon and I've been beating myself up because I'm walking, I'm in a marathon, I should be running. But then I've had to reframe it and go, do you know what? There are some people who would absolutely love to be able to walk this course because they can't. So there's always somebody worse off than you. And there's always someone better off than you as well. And just trying to not compare yourself. Comparison is the thief of enjoyment, and I can say this now, but I was having a session with someone, with my therapist on Monday about not comparing myself, because quite often you're comparing, excuse the pun, but you're comparing apples and oranges. They're totally different, so they're never going to be the same, but we still compare ourselves, and that's where things like social media are awful for that, because when we live in our own world, we become happy with what we've got. And then we're suddenly exposed to, oh, well, they're doing this and they've got this and they're doing that. And it makes us feel either inadequate or, we haven't got that. And I should be doing this. I should be doing that. Quite often we don't want to be doing that. And what different people see as successful is different to all of us as well. So, that theory of, a family and a nice house and a nice car and a great job, half the time they're the most miserable people ever. And you can see people who literally have nothing. And I often see this in countries like Africa. They have literally nothing, no shoes. They're doing the same clothes that they've been wearing. They're dirty, but they have such community and the biggest smiles on their faces because they don't know any different. And they just, they just go for the simple life. And I think sometimes a simple life is a happy life, but the more complex it is, the harder it is to navigate, I guess.
Yeah, very much so, isn't it? It takes us away from those core things of community. And, those things are really, really important. I often mention those as things as being good for my mental health, and we tend to, when we talk about stuff that's good for mental health, we go for the low hanging fruit, yoga, sleep, exercise, all this stuff, really, really important. But yeah, there's stuff like community, isn't it? And you talk about comparison there. I think it's really good to kind of work out what you value in life and what you what your core beliefs are, and then start to think about whether you're living your life in alignment with those. Because if we're constantly looking at what everyone else is doing, we can lose sight of what we want our lives to be. And when there's a gap between, how we're living and how we really feel we should be living, that's a gap we can fall down sometimes as well, right?
It is. And I just wonder why schools don't teach the values, and sort of allowing young people to tap into what their value, what matters to them. It's not the PlayStation, or it's not the, or even algebra. When have you ever used your algebra? But it would be good to have known what my core value, what matters to me, and to live my life in alignment to that. And I think that would stop a lot of problems if people could just recognize, well, that's fine, that's their values, that's what they do, but mine are this, and I'm going to stick to that. I'm very honored to be one of the national ambassadors for the Army Cadet Force, and the services I served for 22 years myself in the Army, and you get taught some core values. And I think for some of the young people that are cadets, they've got those core values, and they're really great young people and citizens. And then actually, once they've learnt them, they push their boundaries a bit more. And once you do that, you grow and grow. So, I think that's something that, maybe that's up to parents to do. But if it was reinforced in schools rather than it all being, academic and You know, how many parents will say, oh, you know, little Johnny's got to, you know, these grades, or he's got, you know, he's got this and that. Well, do you know what? Is he happy? You know, can they talk to other people? You know, it's not always for some people. That's great and that's fine. But we're not all the same. None of us are the same.
Yeah, that's it. It's when the, you know, a lot of problems occur when we try and, you know, when there's this, I suppose it's like, for a basic analogy, it's the whole, like, I can't think of the right phrase, but they're like the square, the round hole of the square. You know, once that sort of stuff starts happening, you know, it causes people a lot of problems, isn't it? There's one system, not everyone fits in that system. And, you know, the people that don't fit are made to feel less than, when in reality, the system's at fault.
That is exactly, you know, this is one key thing that one therapist kind of worked through with me. And she said, do you know about the salad and the lemonade bottle? And I thought, oh my God, I'm worse than I thought I was. I'm really, you know, I really am in, you know, in not in great place. And she said, you know, there's nothing wrong with a lemonade bottle and there's nothing wrong with a salad. They just don't, you just wouldn't put lemonade on your salad. And for me with the army, this took a long time to recognize that, you know, actually, yeah, the army was the salad and I was the lemonade bottle, and I just didn't fit. And I've probably grown more since I, you know, have been able to do more and be more of a me. You know, running as a piece of fruit doesn't fit that well with being in the army. You know, there's a hierarchy, there's a discipline, and if people don't like that, they'll stop it. But actually, I'm my own person now. So, but other people are the lettuce or the tomato, and so they do fit in the, you know, in the salad of the army. So, yeah, it's working out if you're a lettuce or tomato,
yeah,
or it's a lemonade bottle.
Yeah, sounds like she's given you some good suggestions for future outfits as well.
I just distinctly remember that conversation, and always having to sort of go, hang on. Am I trying to fit into a salad? Am I trying to fit into a fruit salad or a vegetable salad? Yeah. And that's where, if you're a tomato, you're actually a fruit, and people think you're a vegetable. So wisdom is knowing not to put a tomato in a fruit salad.
There you go. Yeah, there you go.
I get a bit of fruit in everywhere.
Was that a big decision for you, Sally, coming out of the army then? Was that something you had to kind of...
It was difficult because it wasn't my decision. It was taken out of my hands because I was deemed too unwell to continue in the army. And somebody said, it's just not the right environment for you. And I battled against that because it had been, you know, for 22 years, that's all I'd want, you know, I'd wanted to do and been around and been a part of. It was such a big part of my life that, yeah, it wasn't something that I wanted, and I'd achieved in that time as well. And you know, when I'm well, I'm good, and I got promoted, and you know, I got to the rank of major. But when I wasn't so well, it wasn't understood. I don't think. And you know, as somebody who cries a lot, I basically have learned that if I'm tired, I'll cry. If I'm angry, I'll cry. If I'm upset, I'll cry. That emotion, I think when I was younger, I wasn't allowed to be angry. You know, we need anger. You know, if something frustrates you, you go up to your bedroom, you slam the door. I'd get told off for slamming the door. So I then just cried, and it seemed to be okay to cry. So it was hard to be the officer that was crying all the time, because that doesn't fit with, you know, how you should be. Yet, you know, guys would possibly go out and punch someone or something, or so, you know, the amount of patience I'd have with their hand, they'd come in and they'd punched a wall or something, and that's just, you know, that was their anger. It's just that my anger was in crying, and people could see that, and yeah, it didn't serve, that vulnerability didn't really serve, you know, in where it was. But at the same time, my job, you know, I wasn't an infantry soldier, I was a physiotherapist. So for me, understanding others and understanding the emotions that they go through, you know, that's an important thing to do. So, yeah, it was difficult. It was a really difficult time. But that's the cards, you know, that's the hand that I was dealt. And once I'd kind of got over that and accepted it, I think for me it was quite lucky that I was then asked to be the National Ambassador for the Army Cadets, because I still have a link in with that world, but I'm still my own person. So now if I'm talking to a general, I haven't got to be, I can be Sally. I haven't got to be Major Orange. So I've still got that link to it, but in a slightly different way. It's just adapting.
Yeah.
Had you asked me a couple of years ago, I'd still be in a really difficult and dark place about it, but I can look back now and reflect and see that I've been able to do okay.
Yeah.
Situation.
Oh, mate, it's lovely. I think, you know, identity is a big deal, isn't it? And, you know, when we do something for a long time, it becomes part of us. And then when that's not there anymore, it's almost kind of like a grieving to it, yeah. I think, those big changes, right? And you just have to, grief is a process that just has to kind of do its thing, right? You just have to sit in it and wait for things to change.
Yeah, you know? The acceptance doesn't come straight away. And I think it definitely is a grieving situation of who you were and what you are now. And that takes time. You know, I was thinking this morning that how often do we hear that time is the greatest healer? And you just think, I don't want to have to go through this. But yeah, it serves its purpose. And if we can help other people learn from our experiences, then sometimes it can stop them getting to that point in the first place. And that's what I'm trying to do with the fruit, is just sort of saying to people, it's okay. And it's okay to get help. And actually, if you get help, get through that process a lot quicker, because you've got someone to help navigate you rather than having to fight it all by yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, that reminder that there can also be something really, really lovely on the other side. You know, it's not a case of like getting through something and then having to constantly get through it or constantly worrying about it coming back. You know, the lovely things can still happen. You know, you can still do wonderful things. It doesn't hold you back like you think it will when you're in it. You think, that's it, I'm done, I'm never gonna see like brightness again. But you really can, right? And you really
I think that's where my name suits that, because you know, the future's bright, the future's orange.
That's it, mate. Yeah, completely. I really wanted to ask about like these challenges, some of the ones you've done, the particularly long ones, you know. And we've mentioned these things that are good for mental health, things like sleep. Well, when you're running 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents, I'm guessing your sleep quality wasn't the best, you know. And a lot of the things that most of us as humans have to do every day to be mentally healthy are probably not possible when you're in these challenges. So how do you balance that out, Sally? You know, when you're in the moment, you know, and I'm going to guess that there's some dark times along the way in that moment that you just kind of have to sort of grind through, you know?
Yeah, I knew that sleep deprivation was going to be, you know, I looked at the situation, I thought, what do I think I'm going to find difficult? And so with the resilience coach, I kind of, you know, worked on visualizing how lack of sleep is going to affect me, or what can I do to really maximize my potential to be able to sleep. And if I wasn't sleeping, what I could use in my head to be telling me that it's okay that I'm not sleeping because I'm resting. So it was using the brain. But I think I actually a lot of the time used my illness, that deepest, darkest time in 2013, as a powerful thing of going, you still don't feel as bad as you did then. So you got, that was my cookie jar. So almost my illness is in my cookie jar as a positive now, because I can go, you got through that. I don't know how, but you did get through that. I think it's just quite often reframing the situation as well. So the one marathon, I cried from mile 8. I was in so much pain with my stomach, and I just cried. And that's where I was there going, doesn't matter that you're walking, some people would love to be able to walk this. And yeah, just to try and reframe some of those things. But it took preparation, and then some of the things that I hadn't expected to be a problem. So I mentally prepared for the lack of sleep, but I hadn't prepared for a stomach bug. So, you know, when the coach had sort of said, you know, what are the things that are, you know, that are worrying you, and we'll work on how you can overcome them when they happen. We hadn't done that for a stomach bug. But I had to use the tools that I'd used before with the sleep, the tools were exactly the same, whatever the situation. It did make it tough. But now I can use that to say, I've done this. And to be honest, it's a month on now from when I did it, and that's only just starting to sink in, because I've struggled with a few things even since coming back, getting there now.
Yeah, because that must be a come down, right? To ask that much from your body and your mind over, you know, a long stretch of time, and then, you know, like you fly home and it's all done, and you know, 24, 48 hours after crossing that last finish line, you're in your kitchen, you know, in your salad, yeah, and you're having a cup of tea. That it's a big shift, right?
It is, and I didn't really feel the high from it, which sounds, because I guess the thief of enjoyment, I was comparing myself with others, you know, other people had raised more money than I had, and so then I'd turn it into a bit of a negative that I hadn't raised loads of money. But then I had to look and go, well, what was I there to do? Why was I doing it? It wasn't necessary. I mean, yes, that was one part of it, raising money, but it was raising awareness. And again, going back to the values of, you know, I hadn't set out and said, right, I want to raise 100,000. And that's what was holding me back from enjoying that. I've done a lot of adventures now to know that there is that post-expedition blues, but I manage them better because I know that they're going to happen. So again, I've learned from experience to, you know, not book anything in too much to try and keep going, you know, to have a period of actually you need to just take this in and recover. And but also, you know, an everyday person, it's the same with a holiday. You know, we go on holiday and you start to come towards the end of that holiday and you're like, oh God, I've got to go back to my real life. And then you have a bit of a lull when you get back, because it all comes back, the normality of life. So what I often did was just on the plane on the way home, I'd be going, right, where do I want to go next? What's my next holiday going to be? What can I work towards? You know, I'll save my money to be able to go here. So it gives you purpose again to that next holiday, accepting I am going to feel a bit rubbish, I've got the washing to do when I come home, and you know, work will have piled up to catch up with everything when you go back in, and you'll open all those emails, but it doesn't have to be a challenge. I think we all have that lull of a, you know, after a holiday, and you come back and you should be on top of the world, and you were, and a day or two, and just everything comes back to you. I just don't think it has to be a challenge. And just to make it more relatable to everyday people and everyday situations.
Yeah, it's that acceptance, isn't it? You know, we've kind of touched on that before, but it's so important, whether it's a period of low mood or whether it's a depressive episode or whatever you're going through, the kind of, you know, rather than trying to wrestle it into being what you need it to be, or sometimes you've just got to just accept and just do the best you can and ride it out.
And that is one of the therapies that I have found, you know, really quite useful, because there's CBT, so cognitive behavioral therapy, but ACT, so acceptance and commitment therapy, is actually what I've had to sort of learn. And so, you know, exactly what you were saying, it's accepting. So when that thought comes into my brain of, you didn't raise much money, I raised over £12,000. So it's all a spectrum, but kind of going, thank you, thought. It's this old story. Here's the raising money story coming again. Thank you very much. I know that you're there, and thank you for reminding me, but I don't need that at the moment. And accept it, not, as you say, not trying to fight. And I remember my sister once telling me, when I was in, you know, one of my difficult times, she said, it's like the monkeys in the cage and the banana, and you can put your hand in the cage with the banana and be holding it one way, and you will not get out. That banana will not get out. But if you turn it around another way, the banana comes out of the, you know, out of the bars that are there. It's the same situation, but it's just changing how you go about it, how you look at it, and how you deal with it.
Yeah, I love that, mate. That's such a nice way to, it's that frustration of not being able to get a banana through the bars. You know, I think so many people will relate to that. And then a simple flick of a switch, can kind of make that happen. Oh, amazing. I'm going to start to bring this home, Sally. I'm really conscious of your time today, mate. But I'm going to finish with a really big, obvious question. And I bet you get asked this all the time, but I've got the opportunity to ask it, so I'm going to. But out of all the incredible adventures that you've had, is there any like moments that really, really like stand out for you, whether they're like good ones or bad ones? Is there anything that kind of like springs to mind?
I'm going to tell you one, which is quite a funny one. So it was when I was doing the marathon to Saab. So it was 6.5 marathons in the Sahara Desert, carrying all your own kit. And on the fourth day, it was a double day. So you had to do two marathons back to back. And I'd been really unwell. On the first day, I had sickness and was vomiting everywhere. And then on the second day, I had diarrhea, so this is still having to continue moving forward. And then on the third, of course, you get your feet are getting blistered because you're in sand and running through sand. So on the third day, you sleep under a canvas with a couple of other people, and I, because I hadn't been well, was really thirsty, so I had some water in the middle of the night, and I thought, it doesn't really taste right. It's warm, but everything's warm in the in the desert. And so I drank out of a different bottle of water. And then the next day, we were getting ready to go, and I saw this bright orange bottle. And I said to my friend, "Oh, what electrolyte drink are you using? Because I hadn't seen one with that colour." And he went, "Oh no, you don't want to drink that." And I said, "Oh," and I realised,
oh mate,
that he hadn't had the decency to take 20 steps out of the tent to go for a pee, and he'd actually used his water bottle to go a pee. And so I had drank his pee. And so when I realized, everybody just burst out laughing, and then the next tent laughing because they could hear all these people, and it kind of went round in like a bit of an echo. But actually, at the end, at the airport, someone I didn't know, they said to me, they said, how did you find it? I said, pretty epic. First day I was sick, second day I had diarrhea, third day I drank my tent mate's pee, and they were like, that was you. They said, my goodness, they said, you got me through the marathon to Saab, because anytime I was thinking to myself, this is really tough, I just thought, at least I'm not that girl who's drank her tent mate's pee. So that is one situation that I do definitely remember. But I often tell it to young people, because you never know when you're inspiring other people. And that one person said, you helped me and you inspired me to carry on, because I knew that I didn't have to go through what you'd gone through.
Mate, there you go, huh? That's brilliant. Yeah, just got that person across the finish line without even knowing it. Yeah. Oh, mate, that's wonderful. So you mentioned very briefly at the start, we mentioned your next challenge. Sounds like the conditions are completely opposite, right? So instead of the Sahara Desert, it was the North Pole, you said, Sally.
That's right, yes.
And is that a marathon again, marathon distance?
It is, marathon, marathon at the North Pole. But yeah, I just feel that, what a privilege. How many people get to go to the, to the North Pole? So, I want to get my money's worth. I don't want to be quick. I don't want to go, be first, because you haven't experienced it. So I'm going to get my money's worth, and I'll see other people doing it, and look around me, and just appreciate how lucky I am to be there.
Yeah, when's that happening? What's the date for that?
It's my birthday on the 7th, so I fly into Svalbard on the 7th. I think it's actually the 9th. We have a few race briefings and about the flight over to the North Pole. So 9th or 10th, weather depending.
Yeah. Oh, mate, that sounds like a wonderful experience, and I wish you all the best with it, mate, and all the best of everything. I've enjoyed chatting today so much, Sally. It was really, really lovely. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Tom. It's been really, really great to chat with you as well.
Oh, super. You take care, mate. Big up to the Proper Mental Podcast. The Proper Mental Podcast.